This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Arab world is undergoing a transformation, and no one really knows where it will lead. My guest, Mark Lynch, has been closely following the protest movements, including the one in Libya, where the U.S. is participating in military action to enforce the no-fly zone sanctioned by the U.N. Security Council, which also called for an end to Muammar Gaddafi's attacks against civilians. Lynch co-edited the new e-book, Revolution in the Arab World, Understanding the Upheaval While It's Happening. He's the director of the Institute for Middle East Studies and the Project on Middle East Political Science at George Washington University. He edits the Middle East Channel for Foreign Policy Magazine's website and writes his own blog on that site. He's the author of a book about Al Jazeera and Middle East politics. Mark Lynch, welcome to Fresh Air. You seem to see both sides of the Libya intervention question. What are the pros and cons of the U.S. interceding as it's done? The pros and cons as you see them.
Well, the cons are enormous because, you know, anyone who's lived through the last 10 years and lived through Iraq can understand all the reasons why we want to be very wary about intervening in another Arab country without a great deal of thought about what kind of role we might have to play in a post-war Libya or a post-war Iraq, and really having to worry about all the unintended consequences of something which seemed like a good idea going in. And I think that I, like many of us, look around and we see that a lot of these questions don't seem to have been answered or even asked. On the other side, I spend a lot of time reading Arab blogs, talking to Arabs, watching Arab media, and I can see how important Libya really is to what's happening inside the Arab world right now. And you can see that there was this incredible momentum towards change, where the hopes of everybody in the region were being raised, and then when you got Gaddafi beginning to respond with really brutal violence, it had an effect across the entire region, and they did look to the United States and to the international community to rescue something which was going badly wrong. And so I think what you have is a real gamble, where we see that an intervention is in many ways the moral thing to do, and it could have really positive region-wide effects. But if it goes wrong, it could actually bring all of this to a crashing halt.
So what's really at stake in Libya for the West and for the Arab world?
When you're looking around the region, you've got a lot of people who desperately want to try and push for peaceful change. And they saw Tunisia, they saw Egypt, and it led them to believe that it was possible. And in both of those cases, one of the key things was that the armies decided not to shoot on their people. And even though it was tense and it was difficult, it actually showed people that there was a possibility of change. And then what Gaddafi did in Libya, and for that matter, the rulers in Bahrain and Yemen, what they did was they said, no, we're not going to go. And they then used really brutal force against the people. The people didn't back down, but it then stalled and turned into this more of a pitched struggle. If Gaddafi survives, it sends a message to every dictator in the region that force pays, that the way to stay on the throne is to shoot your people if they protest, and the international community really won't do anything about it. And that sends a powerful message both to the dictators and to the people. That's the real stakes in the region.
What about the stakes for the West?
We have a real stake in what this region's going to look like down the road. What kind of Middle East are we going to be dealing with for the next decade? One in which you've had peaceful transitions to some kind of more accountable, more democratic rule, where the people see that the West was on their side? Or do we see a return to kind of sullen dictatorships, angry people who blame the West for standing by while their hopes were crushed? And at the same time, the oil-rich rulers who look around and say, well, the West didn't really help us either. And, you know, those are two very different kinds of worlds that we could be looking at in the next few years.
I think Libya has been much more confusing, at least for Americans, than Egypt. In Egypt, it was clear there was a movement of young people who were for democracy. There were so many of them, and it seemed to be such a truly pro-democracy movement. Whereas in Libya, for instance, there's a New York Times headline today, a struggle for democracy or just a tribal civil war? And that's a question I think a lot of people are asking now. And I think a lot of people are asking, like, Who are the people who are protesting and why are they protesting? And another example I'll give of the confusion is that Richard Engel, the NBC reporter, reported yesterday that some of the rebels who he was asking, why are you protesting, were saying, well, it's because Gaddafi's Jewish. So, like, do we know what the movement is really about and who the protesters really are in Libya?
Well, I think the answer to that is no. I think that our starting point for knowledge about Libya compared to, say, Egypt is incredibly low. In Egypt, a very large number of people, both in the government and journalists, academics, researchers, we knew Egypt very well. We knew who the players were, both inside the government and in the protest movement. And it didn't mean that we could necessarily predict what was going to happen. And there are many questions about Egypt that still remain. But it's not like Libya, where it's almost a black hole of information. One of the legacies of Gaddafi's rule is that he almost completely crushed civil society. And that means that we don't have political parties or trade unions or civil society organizations, human rights organizations, the sorts of people and organizations and institutions that we could see as potential leaders in some kind of new post-Gaddafi Libya. So our starting point of knowledge is very, very low. I had a chance to meet with some of the leaders of the Libyan opposition, and they were at great pains to assure me that they were broadly representative of the Libyan people, that they included representatives of all regions, that they wanted to create a genuine democracy. And I listened to them, and I found them to be very impressive people. But at the same time, they're talking to an American, and they were telling me what I wanted to hear, and I was painfully aware of that. So I don't think that we really know with any confidence what kind of people we're looking at in the Libyan opposition. That said, we do know what we're looking at with the Gaddafi regime. And I think when you compare the two, the unknowns of the opposition don't look quite so bad. We can be quite confident that a post-conflict Gaddafi is going to be far worse than he was before, because he's going to be vengeful. He's going to believe, quite rightly, that the entire world turned against him. And that's going to include the Arab governments that have taken the lead in facilitating a Western intervention. It's going to include the United States, Britain, France. And I think that we have, I would say, a great deal of certainty about how Gaddafi would behave should he survive.
Okay, say Gaddafi doesn't survive, either that he's killed or that he just doesn't survive as the leader of Libya. Do we risk having just like tribal fighting in the wake of that?
Well, I think it's going to be much more difficult to put together a workable, functioning Libyan, more democratic, more accountable state compared to, say, Tunisia or Egypt, where you have, I think, a much more developed infrastructure of civil society, unions, movements, political parties, and so forth. So I don't think that we have to give in to despair and assume that we're going to be looking at another Somalia or another Afghanistan, a kind of ungoverned space full of conflict. But it's a real risk. It also makes it more likely that there's going to be great pressures in a post-Gaddafi situation for people here to start thinking about putting in peacekeeping forces or the boots on the ground that Obama has been at great pains to say we're not going to do. But I do fear that the logic of the situation, when you begin to see turmoil and anarchy in a post-Gaddafi situation, will probably lead a lot of people to say, well, the next step is we can't let Libya turn into a failed state or an ungoverned state. And then next thing you know, we do have a large number of troops on the ground, whether ours or somebody else's.
I have to say, I was so surprised and kind of confused when the Arab League asked for the UN to impose a no-fly zone, when it asked for Western intervention, because I'm so used to the Arab League opposing any Western intervention. And I wonder how you would explain that.
Basically, the big structural change in the region is that the public is far more empowered than it was before. Obviously, in places like Tunisia and Egypt, where you've had actual changes of the government, but even in the rest of the region, the leaders are far more attentive now to what the public wants and what the public thinks. They have to be, because there's so much pressure on them from below. And they don't want to do things now which are going to risk triggering more protest or anger the people. And so there's much more now of a sense that public opinion matters. And the Arab public was deeply invested in the Libya situation. Al Jazeera has been covering Libya extremely tightly, to the exclusion, some would say, of other protest movements such as those in Bahrain, right next door to Qatar. But for the Al Jazeera public, Libya is the number one issue. It might not be the number one issue in American concerns, but for the Arab public, by the time we got to where we are now, this was the top issue for the Arab public. The coverage is very sympathetic to the Libyan opposition, very hostile to Gaddafi. And there's been a very strong interventionist tone to much of the commentary. So you have these graphic images of protesters being killed, and combined with this kind of moral appeal that goes out to, why is the world not intervening? Why is the world not helping us? And this really set the frame for why you saw the Arab League and others welcoming some kind of international intervention. This was being pushed upon the leaders of the Arab world by this empowered public. They really understood what was happening in Libya as the next chapter in this ongoing story that started in Tunisia, spread to Egypt, and they really are looking to see how things end in Libya. That's going to affect what happens in Syria, in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen. And so you get this welcoming on the part of the Arab League, which, as you say, is quite extraordinary.
Now, are some of the countries in the Arab League that ask for Western intervention countries that are run by dictators or strongmen who are themselves under attack?
Yeah, and I think that that's very clear. And indeed, some of the backers of the intervention are simultaneously intervening in Bahrain in order to prop up a king in that country against a very strong protest movement.
Are you referring to Saudi Arabia there?
Yeah, especially Saudi Arabia. But Qatar also, and the UAE. What you have is a combination of them responding to this powerful imperative from below, combined with the fact that Gaddafi has no friends in the Arab world. He has badly alienated and antagonized both the Saudis and the Qataris over the years. So he has no friends in the leading countries in the Arab League right now. And there might also be some sense that supporting a Western intervention in Libya might buy them some space in their own countries, in Bahrain, in Yemen, while the West is both distracted in Libya and also dependent on their support in Libya. So there might have been some calculation there as well on the part of the leaders, which allowed them to align themselves with this empowered Arab public at relatively little cost to themselves.
And it keeps the focus on Libya, not on them. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, uh-huh. Exactly. But there's a major caveat to this. This support is relatively thin because there's a counter narrative out there, which is deeply shaped by Iraq. And it is extraordinary to see the Arab League and Arab publics asking for Western intervention. But that then conflicts with this competing narrative of the United States as imperialist, as the memories of Iraq and Western intervention, and all of the arguments about a war on Islam, wars for oil, general complaints about double standards. One of the lines I've heard the most often in the Arab media and talking to people is no-fly zone over Libya. That's nice. Where was the no-fly zone over Gaza? And all of these things come together into a powerful counter-narrative, which basically says that, yes, we want the West to help, but the minute we start seeing American troops on the ground or Western bombs killing innocent Libyan civilians, then all of a sudden, that's not acceptable. And I'm watching very carefully what's happening in the Arab public debate, and I would say that you're already seeing powerful signs of that shift. When you saw Amr Moussa, the Secretary General of the Arab League, flip from supporting the no-fly zone to complaining about the bombing, that's exactly what I'm talking about, where he's looking at it and saying, well, as long as it was a costless, cheap intervention, that's fine. But when you have Western troops suddenly actually attacking an Arab country, that then brings us back into Iraq territory. Just today, the Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey, who has an extremely gifted ear for Arab opinion, and he's become one of the most popular leaders in the Arab world. Just today, he gave a speech in Parliament where he warned about the West going to war for Libyan oil. And I think that right now, Arab opinion, which was very enthusiastic about an intervention to protect the Libyan people, is already starting to teeter on that edge of having the fears of another Iraq outweigh their desire for helping the Libyan people.
And is that because of the way the bombing is being handled, or because of damage that was done by the bombing? Like, what changed the narrative?
It's inevitable. I think that in the Arab world, I think it's very similar to here in the United States, where the debate about what to do in Libya was very poorly served by how we talked about a no-fly zone. Many people talked about a no-fly zone as if this were kind of a cheap alternative to war. And it's just a matter of shooting planes out of the sky, sending a symbolic message, and emboldening the opposition. But it wasn't actually a war. But of course, that's not what a no-fly zone is. A no-fly zone includes bombing to take out the anti-aircraft capabilities. But that wasn't the way that it was being discussed, either here in the United States or in the Arab world. And so I think what you see now is this kind of visceral shock that this wasn't what we signed up for. When we said we wanted a no-fly zone, we didn't think that meant bombing of Libyan cities or paving the way for a ground intervention. And so I think that part of it is just that shock of not being prepared for the reality of it. This was entirely predictable, but I think that the way we talked about these things, both here and in the Arab world, didn't serve us very well on that.
And one of the things that you've pointed out in your writing is that you think the focus on Libya has distracted attention from Bahrain, where the king is being challenged by a large movement. The king is blaming the challenge on a foreign plot and accusing Iran of trying to create a revolution in Bahrain. Would you try to put Bahrain into context for us? It's a small country. It's a country most Americans don't know much about. So what's the larger importance in the Arab world of the uprising in Bahrain?
What happened in Bahrain is just another example of how what started as this big grand narrative of peaceful popular uprisings against autocracy has been diverted into different kinds of stories. So if Libya, it's turned into civil war and intervention. In Bahrain, what's happened is it's turned into sectarianism and a really nasty resurgence of the Iranian-Saudi Cold War. So basically what happened was you had peaceful protesters who were largely Shia, because the population of Bahrain is a large majority Shia. But the protesters were talking about democracy and human rights, and they very clearly saw themselves as part of the Tunisia-Egypt story. When they began to challenge the king of Bahrain, the response, after initially being somewhat tolerant, the response was to instead paint them as Shia sectarians and to try and rally the Sunni world to their defense against what they increasingly portrayed as Iranian proxies. And once that framing kicked in, you saw this spreading through the entire region, so that now you have major Shia figures like Ali Sistani in Iraq and Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah in Lebanon, now weighing in on the side of the Shia in Bahrain. And major Sunni figures such as Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who's the Islamist figure on Al Jazeera, weighing in on the side of the Sunnis. And so what's happened is that Bahrain has shifted its narrative from being one of popular uprising against a dictator to a Sunni Shia sectarian struggle. And that's been, I think, very, very unfortunate. And what's happening is that Bahrain is that the sectarianism there is actually now spreading out into the region and helping to inflame sectarian tensions elsewhere.
Now, the Saudis intervened in Bahrain against the demonstrators. At the same time, the Saudis were represented in the Arab League and called for UN intervention in Libya. So you have the Saudis taking two different sides here. In Libya, they're supporting the uprising, and in Bahrain, they're supporting the king putting down the uprising.
That's right. And that's why they recast it, saying we can support popular uprisings, but this is a sectarian one. And they're trying to basically write it out of the popular narrative. And it hasn't just been Saudi Arabia. It's been pretty much the entire GCC has rallied.
That's the
Gulf Cooperation Council has rallied to the side of the King of Bahrain. And so, for example, Al Jazeera, which has been covering Libya nonstop, has almost completely ignored Bahrain. And Qatar has contributed, along with several other Gulf countries, to this security assistance force for the Bahraini regime. And so you've seen this rallying effect in the Gulf, where basically they're saying, we're going to draw the line here. There might be revolutions and protests and regime changes in North Africa or even in the Levant, but we're not going to let it come to the Gulf. The other thing which is happening in the Gulf, though, is Yemen, where Ali Abdullah Saleh, the long-serving president, looks to be, as of this morning when we're talking, on his last legs, where his attempt to put down the popular protesters and offer a series of reforms just hasn't succeeded. And you're seeing massive defections from his regime, including major tribal figures, parts of the military. And it's looking to almost everybody that the Yemeni regime is not going to last very much longer. That's going to have huge effects on Saudi Arabia. They share a long border and have a long and conflicted political history there. So in a sense, Saudi Arabia is both, putting its finger in the hole of the dike in Bahrain, trying to stop the floods there, but the wall on its other flank is starting to crumble. And the Saudis are very much feeling encircled and threatened by these changes around them.
If President Ali Abdullah Saleh loses power in Yemen, how might that affect Saudi Arabia?
A lot depends on how it plays out. And so, for example, one of the big questions would be, if Saleh goes, does Yemen hold together as a single state? There's been a southern insurgency for many years demanding separation back into what used to be North Yemen and South Yemen. And there's been an insurgency for several years in the northern part, the Houthi rebellion, which has Sunni Shia overtones. And then, of course, you have Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula with its strongholds in Yemen. And so the real question is, if Ali Abdullah Saleh falls, will he be replaced by some kind of broadly representative and inclusive government which is able to keep the place together, or does everything collapse? I'm actually more optimistic about Yemen than some people are, simply because there actually is a surprisingly robust civil society in Yemen, and a lot of people there have converged for a long time on the sense that Ali Abdullah's regime is actually the problem. That the corruption, the authoritarianism, and the use of violence against the various rebellions has fueled all of these problems, and that there's at least some reason to hope that if peaceful protests manage to bring down the Saleh regime, that the future there will be a lot brighter than, for example, in Libya that we were talking about before.
Now, there are a lot of Islamists who have found a safe haven in Yemen. And I'm wondering, with the with North Africa being in such a state of transformation now, are there places, such as Yemen, where it's possible that Islamists were really increase their power and kind of come out from hiding and actually have more official positions and be in more control.
Well, there's two different ways to think about that, and it's not a perfect distinction, but I think we can broadly distinguish between moderate Islamists and extremists. The moderate Islamists, like Muslim Brotherhood type organizations in Egypt or Yemen, for that matter, they probably will be in more official kinds of positions to the extent that the countries become more democratic. They represent some portion of the population. Many people estimate in Egypt, for example, that they might win 15 to 20% support in real free and fair elections. And that basically generally would be a healthy thing. The more that groups like that are included in parliament, included in the political system, the more incentive they have to continue to avoid violence, to form coalitions with non-Islamists, and you know, to find ways to cooperate with labor unions or leftists on issues of common interest, and basically just to stay invested in the status quo. And so that's basically a good thing. Then you have the extremist organizations like Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who basically see all of these systems, democratic or authoritarian, as equally illegitimate. And they're looking for ways to attack, to undermine, to destroy, to carry out acts of terrorism because they want to try and bring down the system, whatever it is. Democracy, dictatorship, king, doesn't really matter. None of it is an Islamic system in their perspective. And so they're going to be looking for opportunities.
Which are the countries where you think radical Islamists stand the greatest chance of wreaking havoc?
Well, probably the places where they already had a degree of strength, Yemen, some of the North African states, where there's already organizations that are in place. The other part, though, is just the general sense of when you have a very weak state, these ungoverned failed state situations, that often does create openings for those groups to move in where they don't have to worry about being harassed by security forces, and they can create safe havens and the like. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people are worried about Libya. Not so much because the opposition right now is necessarily sympathetic to Al-Qaeda, despite some of the things you hear in the media, but simply because to the extent that you get anarchy and a weak state, it simply creates spaces where groups like that can move in.
Now, you recently got back from an Al Jazeera forum in Qatar, and you were also recently at the University of Beirut talking about the role of the new media in the wave of Arab uprisings. Now, in Egypt, everybody was calling it like the Twitter-Facebook revolution. How has the role of Al Jazeera been changing in terms of its importance in covering these revolutions and uprisings?
I think you have to look at them all together, because what's happened is that the overall information environment has completely changed. So you have the social media, Facebook, Twitter, all the new media, and those have been really important for building connections among activists, for allowing the uploading onto YouTube of user-generated videos and all that sort of thing. Al Jazeera itself very enthusiastically and aggressively moved into the new media space. And so when they were unable to cover events from the ground in Tunisia or Iraq or all kinds of places where they were banned by authoritarian regimes, they were able to discover people they could interview. They could find videos and all kinds of content that they could use and bring online. And it was really quite amazing that when they were kicked out of the country, they often didn't miss a beat. That they were able to continue to cover things, relying on this network of social media activists and YouTube sites and all these things to get this unbelievable video content, which made for gripping TV. And so the lines between the broadcast media and the social media have really blurred over the last 3 months of the Arab uprisings.
What do you think of their coverage in terms of its fairness and accuracy?
Well, I think that they're very professional and they do their job very well. And I think that all of us who are watching it, and that now includes a significant portion of America, able to watch Al Jazeera English, at least on their iPads or on the computer, if not on actual cable TV. I think they've been able to see how riveting the television is and the professionalism of the commentary and the coverage. I think that they've done a stellar job, certainly in Egypt and in kind of working with the this rapidly changing Arab environment. There's some concerns that recently, over the last few weeks, you're hearing more and more complaints about the selectivity of their coverage, and some are saying that they're over-invested in Libya, that perhaps because of the murder of their cameraman, perhaps just because they see this as such a decisive a battle in this larger war, but they see there's been more and more criticism that they focus so much on Libya that they're ignoring protests and uprisings in Bahrain or in Syria and Yemen, and also that they're explicitly siding with the oppositions rather than covering it directly. Those are criticisms that are not unfamiliar to them. They're comfortable with at least the charge of their being on the side of the protesters, because that's their identity, right? Their identity is that they represent the Arab people in the Arab street against the dictators. So they're comfortable with that. But I think they're struggling a bit with the selectivity question. And I think they're really going to struggle if it turns out that Arab opinion begins to shift against the American intervention or the international intervention in Libya, because then they're going to find themselves trapped between their intense advocacy for the intervention and a public opinion which is shifting away from them.
So Al Jazeera is based in Qatar. Is it funded by the government there, and does Al Jazeera's funding affect its coverage at all? Is it affecting its coverage of Bahrain at all?
Well, Al Jazeera is fully funded by the Emir of Qatar, and that can't help but affect their coverage. Many people feel that there's been increasing use of Al Jazeera as a weapon in Qatari foreign policy in recent years compared to the past, and they point to changes in how Al Jazeera covered Saudi Arabia, for instance, when it stopped covering Saudi Arabia critically after there was a diplomatic rapprochement between the Saudis and the Qataris. And it's very rare to see Al Jazeera really critically covering something which the Qatari regime supports. This is a major issue for Al Jazeera in terms of their credibility, and one that they're, I think, very attuned to and trying to deal with, because if they're not seen as this independent voice of the Arab people, then they lose their ability to speak on their behalf. And so it's this delicate balancing act that they walk. As Al Jazeera has become more and more prominent in the last month, especially, this is becoming more and more of an issue, especially with the disproportionate coverage of Libya and Bahrain.
How do the uprisings against authoritarian regimes in the Arab world, how are they likely to affect the future of Israel?
Well, Israel, like the United States, is going to have to adapt to this new reality. I think that before these uprisings, Israel had been able to develop fairly comfortable working relationships with the leaders of most of the Arab governments in the Gulf, in Egypt, in Jordan, and were largely indifferent to the fact that the vast majority of the publics in those countries was becoming more and more hostile as the peace process continued to not exist. And so I think that now that those regimes are either gone or under pressure, Israel is going to have to face a choice about how they are going to deal with these empowered Arab publics. Are they going to just retreat into a shell and just basically resign themselves to an ever more hostile and unwelcoming environment? Or are they going to begin to do things which might allow them to break through that hostility and that wall. And I think that it's such a cliche to say it, but it really is true that the peace process is what's going to make the difference there. If there's some movement back towards serious negotiations, towards a two-state solution, then Israel might be able to navigate this this new environment more easily or more comfortably.
We're living in a time that is might be an incredibly transformative time for the Arab world. And when you look ahead into the future, what are some of the transformations you see, some of the best and worst case scenarios that you see?
You know, we all, over the last 5 or 6 years, we could all see that that the status quo in the Arab world was unsustainable. We all wrote many things and spoke frequently about how the absence of democracy, the crushing socioeconomic problems, corruption, all of the problems of these Arab countries was creating a situation where that was going to be impossible to continue. And that's why we kept urging reform and urging change and urging democracy promotion and the like. By, you know, by 2009, middle of 2010, I think most of us had become discouraged. We basically had come to see that the authoritarian regimes seem to have been able to adapt and to contain and control the challenges to their rule. And we didn't believe that we were living in a democratic moment and that it looked like it was going to be a long haul before these underlying conditions and underlying changes were going to be able to bring about meaningful transformation. And then boom, Tunisia happened, and all of a sudden everything is in ferment and everything seems possible. And it's just a sobering lesson for all of us that that we're likely to be surprised by things. That said, I would say that some things look like they are likely to continue. And one of them is something we were talking about earlier in the show, which is just the general fact that Arab publics are more empowered now than they've ever been, and that that's likely to continue and to escalate. That as you get the introduction and the very, very rapid spread of this new media technology, and actually I think that people should pay attention to the role of web-enabled smartphones in all of this, which basically freed people in the region from the tyranny of poor internet connections and low household internet penetration. But the combination of Al Jazeera, of the new media technologies, and of this real youth bulge. If you look at the demographics in most of these Arab countries, there's very large youth populations who are increasingly educated, who are wired, and who can't get jobs, can't get married. And in a sense, that's the backbone of what we're seeing now of these uprisings, are these wired, empowered, but underserved youth.
The Iranian government managed to smash the uprising there. Is it possible that Iran will emerge a kind of winner at the other end of all this transformations in Arab countries?
I think a lot of people are worried about that. And certainly there are people within Iranian ruling circles who feel that way, who think that it's primarily American allies who have been undermined, and with Hosni Mubarak gone and the Saudis in trouble, there's a sense that this strengthens the Iranian position. I'm not sure that that's right in the long term. Iran has been largely irrelevant to the protests that are going on. They've tried to reach out and brand this as an Islamic awakening and got virtually no takers for it. The only place where Iran has been a factor in any way, really, has been Bahrain. And there it's been in this very negative sense of reintroducing sectarianism and the Sunni-Shia divide into the Arab public sphere. For one thing, because they crushed their own democracy movement, that really makes them look bad in the eyes of this empowered public. Nobody looks to Iran as a model. They see Ahmadinejad, and they see Hosni Mubarak. They see Ali Abdullah Saleh. They don't see the leader of resistance to the West. They see just another dictator who crushed his people. And I think that's been an almost insuperable obstacle for Iran in trying to grapple with these protest movements.
You recently got back from trips to Beirut and Doha, Qatar. You spoke to a lot of young people. You spoke to a lot of leaders of protest movements. You spoke to a lot of media people. What are some of the things that you heard there that will be useful for us to hear in putting into context what's happening across northern Africa now?
Well, I think the fundamental overriding message was this one of things are changing, that you need to pay attention to these voices, treat them with respect, listen to them. There was a palpable just dissatisfaction or even anger, not just with the United States and not just with their leaders, but with their elders, for not listening. And there's this feeling of, we made these revolutions, and we don't need you to tell us what they mean. And there's a very powerful sense among the activists, especially, that they were the ones making this new world, and that they wanted to be treated with respect and to be listened to. There was also a really deep divide, I would say, about some of the big high-profile issues. So on Libya, for example, among young activists, I heard very strong support for international intervention because they identified with the Libyan people, whereas among the older generation of pundits and analysts and commentators, I heard much more of the Iraq analogy and opposition to any form of Western intervention. There's a real generational divide there. And then there's the Palestine question, which is been largely absent from much of the public discourse about what's going on in the broader Arab world. I think that, broadly speaking, almost everybody continues to view American foreign policy through the lens of its support for Israel, and there's a deep identification with the Palestinians as one more example of an oppressed Arab people. But in the younger generation, there's less of a reduction of everything to that single issue. It's seen as one issue among many, whereas I think in the older generation, there's more of an exclusive focus on this, where almost a palpable impatience, where can we stop talking about Egypt so we can get back to Palestine? Whereas in the younger generation, there's this much broader worldview of the region as a whole transforming. And I think from the perspective of the United States, that creates real opportunities to listen and to engage and to act productively on this broader range of issues, which is one of the reasons why American support for helping to see a real, genuine transition to democracy in Egypt and Tunisia, hoping for a positive outcome in Libya, and really getting these big regional issues right, it's why it matters so much. I think this is one of the first times in a long time where you can see a generation of really politically significant activists and just individuals all over the region who are looking to the United States with a relatively open mind. Doesn't mean they're sold on us, but it also doesn't mean that they're automatically rejecting it. And I think there's a real chance to get this right.
Well, Mark Lynch, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Mark Lynch is the co-editor of the new e-book, Revolution in the Arab World. He directs the Institute for Middle East Studies at George Washington University. He blogs at Foreign Policy Magazine's website, and he edits the site's Middle East channel. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also find a link to Lynch's blog. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.